All right. Well, this will be officially our last week in this New Year series that I've titled, again, Being of God, where again, we've been looking at what it means for us to be of God in various different roles that we have. We started off, and again, I continue just to emphasize the starting point of just being in the heart of God. All right, I've said it pretty much each and every message, and I'll continue to say it one more time here this morning. But again, the heart of God is not one of condemnation. It's not one of condemning you, but it's one of salvation. All right, then when we looked at the story of when the woman guilty of adultery was brought before Jesus, Jesus said that whoever is without sin should throw the first stone. And then as each man walked away, because they realized not only was Jesus right in the law, but he was right in grace, Jesus turned to the woman. He asked her, like, well, where are those who condemn you? And when she said they're no longer here, Jesus told her, then neither do I condemn you, that you should go forth and sin no more. When she was brought and laid at the feet of people and being told that she was deserving of death, Jesus came and he brought her life. Right? And for each of these messages that we've been going over, this, I think, continues just to be the foundation and the echo of what we want to go over. That again, God is not one of condemnation, that if you hear this voice telling you that you haven't been doing things right, that you haven't been everything that you are, and that you're beyond the grace of God, that's not God speaking to you. That continues just to be a voice within you that we need to suppress. So we need to embrace the fact that we're in sin, but it's not sin that defines us, but it's the grace of God that defines us. And so from the heart of God that we looked at, we then transitioned into seeing what it meant to be, first off, men of God. Again, I wanted to start with the men because we're to lead, as we'll kind of dive into here a little bit as well. But looking at the creation of man, we saw God's purpose for man. And last week, we then looked into what it meant to be a child of God, right? How every life, especially and in particular those of the unborn, that they are all precious to God, that every life is precious to God because all of us are created in God's image. And so today we're going to conclude going from men to children and now to women. We want to look at what it means to be a woman of God. Right? And men, just like I told the woman during your week, in a sense, this isn't a time for you to tune out. This is a chance for you to kind of hear, like, what does a woman of God sound like? What are the qualities and characteristics that define a woman of God? And I hope that in hearing of these things, this tells you as men, like, what you should be looking for in a woman, or what you should be running from if there's a woman that you have, that you've been experiencing these things. Or, again, if you've already found your wife, then this gives you an opportunity to encourage her. This gives you an opportunity to hold her accountable. Now, this is a chance for you, again, to continue to help in God's design for her. And so real quick, if you have your Bibles, your devices, whatever it may be, if you can turn, we're going to be in 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2, if you're in the Christian Bible, the New Testament, essentially, it's about halfway through, give or take. And again, as you're getting there, let me kind of lead into a little bit of background so you understand where we are in this letter, where we are in this story, in a sense. And so Paul wrote this letter, and no surprise, to Timothy, and being that it's 1 Timothy, this is Paul's first letter to Timothy, implying that, again, there's at least number two. But between 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, these are kind of known in the Christian world as the pastoral epistles. These are three letters that Paul wrote to kind of give more instruction in how it is to kind of lead in the church. And compared to his other letters, like we've been going through Romans, and we'll probably dive back into that in a couple weeks here, but in comparison to like Romans or Ephesians or Galatians, all these other letters that Paul wrote, these letters in general, they're much more informal. They're also a lot less focused on theology, of trying to show this is the sovereignty of Christ and how Christ is man and Christ is also God and this is how salvation works, all these things. Paul doesn't dive as much into that, into these, but instead he focuses on how are we supposed to run the church? How are we supposed to do things? How are we as leaders, again, specifically as Timothy as pastor and Titus as a leader as well, how are they to run the church? So it's much more practical and much more, again, focused on the how to do rather than the why to do. But in the first chapter of Timothy, 1 Timothy rather, Paul told Timothy that he needed to push back against false teachings. Right, that there are lots of false teachings in Ephesus where Timothy is pastoring at. And Paul is saying, you need to push against those things. Again, we're not really told specifically what those teachings were. We can make guesses and things here or there. That doesn't really help us in our message that we're looking at today. So all we need to know is that there are false teachings being taught. And Timothy is told here, you need to fight against those men. You need to push back against those people who are teaching wrongly. And then here in chapter 2, Paul starts to go into some practical things for men first, and then now in this section we'll look at here, in women. Like, how can we live out practically, again, fighting against these false teachings, and again, how we can be women of God. Now, before we dive into this passage, I want to throw out two qualifiers real quick. First off is that when it comes to our history, not just as a country, but also sometimes in how we've used the Bible, we've in the past have seen people use the Bible to abuse and to tie down women into positions that they were never supposed to really be in. And those people who have done that, those times that that's happened, those are 100% sin. Like, there's no argument, there's no justification for it. Those times were sin. Like, they should not be using the Bible to hold down women or put women to a place that they weren't supposed to be in. The Bible tells us that we're to live, right? Whether to live as godly men, godly women, or again, as children of God, as we've been going through. It doesn't tell us how we're supposed to force others to live the way that we want them to. Like, I shouldn't take this Bible, I shouldn't take this passage that we're about to go into, and I shouldn't go to my wife and say, like, hey, this is why you're supposed to do this for me. Like, that's not what the intention of the Bible was. It's not to strong arm my wife to doing what I want her to do. No, instead, again, I'm supposed to read through this word. I'm supposed to read through the scriptures that God has given to us and see how the light of the gospel changes me, how I live in submission to Jesus. And ultimately, and in her admonition from this Bible, that she's supposed to live in submission to me. And we'll get to more of what that means here in just a little bit. But that's the first thing is, again, people have used this Bible wrongly, and that is 100% sin. The second thing that I want to mention here is, on the other side of that, our culture has said that in comparing men and women, that they are the same. Like, we're not even just equal, but we're the exact same. There's no difference between man and woman. And I would argue that too is sin. That men and women are equal. We are created equal, but we are also uniquely different. We have unique roles and responsibilities we've been given to us by God. That men have been created to complement women, and that women have been made to complement men. That we are both individuals uniquely made to complement one another. And ultimately, it doesn't matter how I feel about this. It doesn't matter how our culture feels about this. Because it's God's law that determines whether we follow it, or it's God's law that determines things, and we follow it regardless of how we feel. Just like, again, even in our laws that we look at today, I may feel like as I drive out of the parking lot here, I'm like, I feel like the speed limit should be higher here. But that doesn't change the fact that if I speed on it, I'm still breaking the law. I can feel one way about things, but that doesn't change the law. In the same way that again, we can feel something about how the Bible may have written things or whatever it may be in our culture and our society today, but that doesn't change God's law. So again, with all of that out of the way, let's go and dive into the passage. We'll see three characteristics that I think Paul breaks out for us in telling us what it means to be a woman of God. So again, this is going to be 1 Timothy chapter 2. We're going to start in verse 9 and go to the end of the chapter to 15. So verse 9. Likewise, also that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel, with modesty and self-control, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly attire, but with what is proper for women who profess godliness, with good works. Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control. That's what we get from 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 9 through 15. And so the first thing that I think we look at, the first characteristic that I think Paul develops for us in terms of what is a woman of God, is that women of God have godly appearances. Right, in these first two verses, Paul tells us that a godly woman has a godly appearance. Now, don't get me wrong, I am the last person that you would probably talk to about style. Men's style, but more even so, women's style. Like, I'm the guy who looked at a dress and said, that's a mullet dress. Only for Brittany to come and tell me, like, no, that's called a high-low dress. And I'm like, no, I know a mullet when I see one. That's a mullet dress. I'm like, that's what it is. So again, don't look at me for style. So I'm not going to go off of it in this area. But joking aside, Paul here instructs these women that they should dress in what he calls, in verse 9, respectable apparel. Right? Paul is saying that they need to do this with modesty and with self-control. But what you notice here is that there's a giant lack of specificity here. Right? Paul isn't saying that godly women should wear this type of top and wear this type of skirt, wear this type of dress at all times, or that they're supposed to wear these colors and not those colors, whatever it may be. Because what Paul is saying here is it's not so much about what you're wearing, it's the mindset that you have as you wear things. Right? That as a woman, when you get dressed each and every day, as you choose the clothes that you're putting on, are you more concerned about what others are thinking of what you're wearing, or are you more concerned about what God thinks of what you're wearing? I think that's the mindset that Paul is communicating to us here, that a godly woman will have when it comes to, she has the mindset of what God wants more than what others think of her. She dresses in a way that, again, points people to God more than it points towards herself. But then what about this section that comes after, where it talks about braided hair and gold or pearls or stuff like that? Or like, are braids evil? Like, are we not supposed to have braids in our hair? Are we not supposed to wear gold or pearls or earrings or all kind of stuff? Are those things evil? Is that not what we're supposed to be doing? I think this is one of those cases where you have to understand the principle of what Paul is saying and not exactly the terms. That the terms being used here are cultural, but the principle is what continues on. See, what Paul is talking about here is not exactly that you aren't supposed to wear fancy braids or gold or pearls or things like that. What he's doing is that he's communicating what this is talking about. He's communicating who typically has these things. Because the women who have normally had braided hair with gold or pearls interwoven into their hair and fanciful, all this stuff, the women who had those things were the temple prostitutes of other religions. And so Paul is saying, don't dress like them. Don't be like them. That even though that might be the style that's accepted, that even though that might be okay in other places other than in our church, that godly women will hold themselves to a higher standard at all times. For us today, maybe that means for you that even though our culture says, like, this skirt is in style, that that might be too short and you should look at something different. Or perhaps the blouse that you're wearing, well, again, might be something that says, hey, this is okay in the workplace or this is okay somewhere else, but perhaps that's just too low and you should think about whether you want to put that on. Keeping in mind that, again, as Paul is writing all of this, he's writing this to the women in the church of Ephesus. In particular, again, Paul is putting emphasis on what you wear coming to church. This applies to everywhere, but again, he's writing to what they're wearing as they enter into the worship. See, a godly woman should have such a hatred towards sin that she doesn't want to even distract others. She doesn't even want to lead others into sin by what she wears. And no, this isn't just about men being distracted by a woman wearing something too scandalous, although I think that is part of what he's getting at. I would actually argue that I would even argue that women look at other women's clothing and judge them harder sometimes than men do. And so what we're talking about in having godly appearance is preventing both men and women from sinning, from being distracted, from being pulled away from the worship of God in his house. And ultimately, again, in verse 10, what Paul talks about here is that it's a godly woman who professes her godliness in not what she wears externally, but what she does internally. That her good works profess her godliness. That it's not focusing, again, on her externality, but it's focusing on her internal gospel that just radiates within her. That the most attractive woman would not be the one with the fanciest dress on, but would be the one with the greatest gospel displayed for all to see. And the last thing I'll kind of talk about here in looking at godly appearance is perhaps you might think like, well, I think it's okay for me to wear this. I think I'm okay with this. Why should I have to suffer because that person is too weak? Why should I have to suffer because that person can't control themselves? And for that, I'd like to point us to what Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 19, or chapter 9, verses 19 through 23. And I've shortened it, and I may even shorten it a little bit more just to not read the entire thing. But you have the passage there. Paul says at the very beginning, for though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them to Christ specifically. And so he says, to Jews I became a Jew, to those who held themselves under law, to those who restricted themselves. When he evangelized them, he would restrict himself and hold himself in that kind of way. To those who were weak in their understanding of the gospel, he wouldn't come down hard on them. He would be weak with them so that they could understand better of what the gospel meant. This is where we have this famous phrase in that Paul says, I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. And he does all of this for the sake of the gospel. Right? Paul sacrifices himself, he sacrifices his freedoms for the sake of the gospel. And so the point I'm getting at here is that even if you feel comfortable with what you're wearing, even if you think everything is okay, Again, if it causes another person to stumble, if it causes somebody else to suffer in the gospel, it might be better that you slave yourself to that rather than embracing the freedom that you know that you have. Again, all for the point of professing and displaying the gospel for all to see. The second thing that we'll kind of dive into here is in the next two verses, verses 11 and 12. And I'll just reread them to kind of go through it. It says, "Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet." I think the second characteristic that we look at of a woman of God is that she has godly conduct. Right? A godly woman conducts herself as God commands. And this is probably one of the more controversial verses that we have in this section. There's another one that we'll have to deal with here in a few verses as well. But I think if we look at this and we analyze what exactly is Paul talking about, the controversy only exists because we take this out of context. So first, let's look at how a first century Jewish worship service would have gone down, because I think that gives us understanding of what Paul is getting at here. In a first century Jewish service, if we were to model our church like that, depending on how big the synagogue was, depending on how many people were there, you could have it set up in multiple ways. If there were enough men to fill up this place, the men would be here. The women would be either in the AV room in the back or the kitchen in the back, not because of what's in there, but just they would have been separated from the men. The men would have been in one spot. The women would have been in another. In our case, if we were something like this, we would put maybe the men on this side and the women on this side. And specifically, they had something called, and again, I'm going to try to say this, I'm not Jewish, I don't know, but I think it's pronounced the Metzika, I think is how they would say it. They would put something that would physically divide the room in half so that the men were on one side and they could not see the women on the other. Their idea was, again, to keep them separated so that they would learn, they would spend more of their time focusing on what the pastor was saying, what the rabbi was saying, rather than what the other people were doing. And so again, what we have here in verse 11, Paul says, "Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness." What Paul is getting at here is it's an imperative statement. What he's saying isn't just a matter of opinion. What he's saying isn't just like, I think this is how it should go. Paul is saying, this is how it's supposed to be. This is how you're supposed to do. This is a command from Paul. And specifically, the command here is to let a woman learn. That women are to learn the passage. They're to learn the scriptures. They're to learn from God. They're to learn what it means to be a woman of God. Paul isn't making this as a way to belittle women. He's not trying to oppress women. He's telling them that they are encouraged and they are supposed to learn. The only qualifier he has to it is that they're supposed to learn quietly. And when he says quietly, this doesn't really mean like complete silence. There's another word in Greek that they would use to say that you should remain completely silent. What they're really kind of phrasing is a God-produced calmness. That in a worship service, the women were supposed to learn in a way that produced calmness, that produced peacefulness. In the same way that we have in verse 9 and 10 where it says, don't be loud in what you wear. Paul is saying that as you learn, don't be loud vocally. Don't distract the worship with your voice. And again, just to give you the full context of what we're talking about here, if we're looking at a Jewish ceremony, if you have men on one side and the women on the other, sometimes what would be happening is the woman would be on this side and they'd be like, what does this mean? And they're trying to ask the men on the other side. They're trying to ask somebody on the other side. And they're saying, you're distracting from the instruction of the gospel. The rabbi, the teacher is up here trying to explain the gospel. And instead of being able to do so, there are people saying and distracting and they're trying to teach what they think is actually right. I think the best way I can explain this in our 21st century is, again, I went to for my undergraduate, and sometimes in our classes we would have what's kind of known as non-traditional students, right? They're people who have aged, who have gained more life experience, and for whatever reason they decided they wanted to come back and to go after the degree, right? Great for them. No issues with that whatsoever. But sometimes with these non-traditional students, you would have these times where the teacher, the professor was going over things, and then the student would then ask a question. They would start trying to talk about their life experience. They would start trying to talk about the things that they went through to teach for the professor. And to a certain extent, it's kind of like, hey, like I'm glad that you're here. I'm glad that you want to learn. But I'm not paying for this class so that I can hear you talk about your life. Like, I'm here because I want to listen to what the professor is trying to teach me. And that's the same idea that I think Paul is illustrating for us here. That these women are coming to learn, but at the same time, they're interrupting and they're distracting and they're pulling from their own experiences. They're pulling from their own understanding and trying to teach what they think is right rather than letting the rabbi, letting the teacher, rather than letting the elder teach the gospel itself. And so Paul is encouraging Timothy to put this to an end, to restrict the women who are distracting the instruction of the gospel, that they need to learn, but learn quietly in submissiveness. And then in verse 12, he continued and he says that women are not to teach or exercise authority over a man. Now, Paul doesn't forbid women from teaching ever, because if you look through other letters that Paul has written, he encourages the women. He praises them for what they've done. The most probably big example that you hear is Priscilla and Aquila. And the reason why I mention those two is they taught Apollos. But the reason why I specify them is because when you see Priscilla named first, it's argued that she had a bigger impact in his teaching than her husband Aquila did. That's why she's listed first. Priscilla and then Aquila. And Paul praises them. He praises this couple, but he praises them in their teaching of Apollos, of another pastor. At the same time, you have Phoebe, who was a deaconess, and she was praised for her service as well as her teaching of the other women. In Titus, he tells us that the older women are to teach the younger women. So again, Paul is not saying that women should never teach ever. I think what he's doing here and looking at these two things, the only other position that is to teach and to exercise authority is that of the elder. And so I think what Paul is telling us here is not that women can't teach, but that women should not be the lead pastor. Right, and to defend all of this, because I think he does a better job here in this back half, let's dive into the last characteristic that I think Paul gives us here as to what is a woman of God. And we'll see how he defends this position that he gives us here. So again, this is going to be the last section, verses 13 through 15. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control. And so the final characteristic of a woman of God is that she was created in godly design. Right, the reason that Paul says that a godly woman should not be the elder of a church is because it's part of God's design that she would not be. Right off the bat, in verse 13, Paul says for us here that Adam was formed first and then Eve. That God created and designed Adam to lead in the same idea that God created and designed man to lead woman. God created this order in the church. He created this order in the house. And we are not to violate his order. In fact, the first time that this was violated, Paul talks about here. In verse 14, he talks that Adam was not deceived, but that Eve was deceived. And in making this illustration, Paul isn't saying that women can't teach because they're easily fooled. They can't teach because they're easily distracted. That's not what Paul is getting at. Paul is pointing back to the design that God gave us in the garden and how it was ruined by the devil. Because take note, if you go into Genesis, you start in chapter 2 and you look at the order of how things went down. God created all the world. He created all the animals. He created man. And then he told man, do not eat the fruit of this tree. And then he created woman. That was the order that God created things in. And so when Satan came and he tricked Eve into eating the fruit, Satan undermined the created order that God had. Because see, what Adam should have done, because again, if Eve is there talking to the devil, you think Adam isn't with her? Who else is he going to spend time with? So Adam, as the lead, should have came to her and said, no, God has instructed us not to eat of this fruit. Don't listen to the devil who's tempting you to eat this fruit. Adam fails in his leadership. And that's why when you look at all the passages you go through, it all points to original sin. It doesn't say Eve is the one who brought sin into the world. No, it points to Adam. Adam's failure to follow God's created order is what brought sin into this world. And so continuing that and looking at this design that God has created, we look at verse 15. And we see that this is something that, again, is difficult to understand. Because what does it mean for a woman to be saved through childbearing? And I'll quote Dr. David Platt. He's a big pastor and much wiser. I've been doing this a lot longer than I have been. He says you can understand this verse in three simple words. Three simple words basically are, only God knows, right? That we have no idea. There's no way that we're going to know. There's no way that we absolutely will have a complete identification as to what God is talking about here. Only God knows what he means in verse 15. But there are lots of different interpretations, and there are two that I'll point us to here this morning. The first one is that even though Eve was deceived, that she, as through woman, would bring forth child, and in bringing forth a child, the world would be saved. Right? More specifically, it's talking about as how in the future you'll see how Mary brings forth Jesus, that in her birthing Jesus, the world is saved, that she will be saved through childbearing, that she, that the world will ultimately be saved through childbearing. That's one interpretation, and that's one way that I've taught it before in the past. A second one is that God created woman uniquely to bring children into this world. That being saved could also be translated as to preserve, right? That the woman's legacy will be preserved in her bearing children and training them up in faith and in love and in holiness with self-control. Because no matter how much our culture says that men and women are equal, there's only one gender that brings forth the child. Right, and so the second interpretation is that she will be saved. She will persevere her legacy through the children that she bears. Because even though man may have been the lead, women are the only one that bring forth children into the world. Women are the only way that we continue to see our place grow, period. Our world grow, our church grow. It's only through the woman that we are saved and preserved. And so with all of that, let me kind of close off this morning, because there's a lot unpacked. There's a lot to go through. There's a lot to kind of understand better, and I hope that we can kind of do so in Sunday school here in a minute, that we can discuss and kind of look through this passage a little bit more. But let me close by saying, ladies, I want to encourage you to challenge what our culture says about you, that you are not the same as men, that you are created equal, yes, but uniquely different, that you were created to give God glory uniquely as a woman. And that when we hear our culture say that men and women are the same, that they are actually robbing you of your unique opportunity to glorify God in a way that only you can. In a way that only a woman can, that no man can. That only you can glorify God through your appearance in a way that no man can do so. That only you can glorify God through your conduct in a way that no man could ever think of. And that only you can glorify God through your design that no man could ever do. You have a unique opportunity to glorify God. And we shouldn't let this opportunity pass. We shouldn't let this opportunity get away from you. Because each of us are created with a purpose. Each of us are created with a unique responsibility. And it's to glorify God in whatever way, whatever place, and whatever realm that he's placed you in. In whatever household that he's placed you in, under whatever authority that he's placed you in. And so as we finish off this morning, as we finish off this series of what it means to be of God, we recognize his sovereignty, we recognize his plan, we recognize who God is and how he's done things. We continue to submit ourselves to his authority and see that as we become more and more like God, we continue to submit ourselves more and more to his authority. Whether as man submitting to Jesus or as woman submitting to man, we all continue to preserve and we all continue to persevere and we all continue to pursue the gospel Christ has given before us. And we continue to use this gospel again to glorify him and to share him to the rest of the world. And so with that, let me pray for us as we close this morning. Father, again, as we dive through this passage, as we've gone through all of this, again, it is a challenging passage. It is challenging to teach on, especially as a man trying to instruct women, trying to encourage women in your design. God, I just pray that you would continue to open up our hearts and let this message sink in. Continue to open us up to let your view of things take over more than what our culture says things should look like. That we would continue to glorify you in the unique way that you've created each and every one of us. That again, as women, that we can continue to see your glory in the way that we've been created. And that as men, that we can continue to glorify you in the way that you've created us. And so, Father, again, we just pray that you would continue to open up our hearts, open up our minds, and allow us just to worship you and to love you and to continue to see your kingdom grow here on this earth. And God, we just continue to thank you for your son that you sent on the cross for us. That in all things, in all debates, in all conversations, one thing always remains true, that you loved us and you sent him to die for us. And so, Father, again, we just thank you for this opportunity. We continue to praise you, to love you, and to glorify you. We do these and pray these things all in Jesus' name. Amen.